Our first case is Ricardo Sanchez versus Peeper, State of Colorado, case number 2011-SC-215. Petitioner ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the respondent, Peeper, ready? Thank you. A couple of housekeeping matters. Argument is set for an hour, half an hour aside, and Petitioner, you'll have to keep track of your time.
Yes.
And I want to inform the audience as well as the lawyers that some of us use iPads. We have all our briefs, all our notes, and we have links to Westlaw. You can get on the wireless here. I'm not sure if you want you to know that. And we're not using email, but we're following the briefs and following the notes and following the arguments. So you see us looking in our iPads. That's the purpose of it. We're ready to go.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Huff. I represent the defendant, Ricardo Sanchez. I'm a public defender, and my registration number is 34384. I think it might be helpful, given the venue today, that I give the students a little bit of background as to what we're deciding here today. We're not here to decide the guilt or innocence of my clients. That was already determined at a trial. The issue here is very narrow. After the cops arrest you, they must read you your Miranda rights or your warnings before they're allowed to question you. And everybody's seen the shows where they say you have a right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a subsequent court. You have the right to an attorney present. The issue here is, in addition to those other rights that you have, in my opinion, our position, the public defender's position, is that defendants must be fully advised and fully aware of the fact that they also have the right to a free attorney, not just an attorney present. I would say most criminal defendants in Colorado are represented by the public defender's office, which provides free representation. It's critical, in my opinion, that as part of the Miranda advisement, that they also understand that any attorney that they might have would be free of charge. In this particular case, that was precisely what was at issue. Client was questioned by the police officer after the police officer read him some of his Miranda rights, and he said, in particular, "It is not very necessary a lawyer because a lawyer is going to want money, true?" And then he repeated, "Decide a lawyer because the lawyer is going to want money, true?" Instead of explaining to the defendant at that point, yes, typically lawyers get paid. However, if you cannot afford one, one will be provided for you at no cost. The officer said, "Well, the thing is, yes, yes, they are," indicating, "Yes, yes, they are expensive. If you don't have the means of hiring a lawyer, one would be assigned. But the thing is, we are going to talk soon."
Well, let's stop there, because in cases that we've had before involving a Spanish speaker that didn't understand the content,
yes, sir,
what was trying to be conveyed by the advisement or the warning. Now, in this case, we had a Spanish-speaking officer, and the problem here is not understanding what the officer was saying. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct, and that's how I would distinguish Al-Yusuf. Al-Yusuf is this court dealt with the general understanding of the English language. Yes, sir.
Can you just explain for the audience what Al-Yusuf was?
Al-Yusuf was a case where the defendant's first language was not English. It was some sort of Arabic language. I don't recall exactly what. The question was, did he have sufficient grasp of the English language to understand the advisement that he was given? But that's not the issue here, because both parties were speaking Spanish. The issue is, did the officer here sufficiently clarify that an attorney would be provided free of charge if Mr. Sanchez could not afford?
What's wrong with the explanation that if you lack the means, you can have an attorney? Isn't that exactly what the officer said?
That is, and to an English speaker, perhaps the words assigned and the means would mean, would translate to, we will provide one to you for free. The problem here is we're dealing with a highly uneducated immigrant, not English speaking, not versed in the ways of the criminal justice system. And our position is, contrary to the Court of Appeals, what the officer said, given Sanchez's repeated concern about being unable to afford an attorney, the officer had a duty under these particular circumstances to ensure that Sanchez understood that what he means by means of hiring a lawyer, one would be assigned, that meant Sanchez did not have to pay for a lawyer. It seems pretty clear that Sanchez wanted a lawyer, but his only concern was he couldn't afford one. Our position is, under those circumstances, you have to be extra careful with the questioning and the answers. And if there is an issue of means of hiring a lawyer, one would be assigned, what does that mean? Do you understand what that means, Mr. Sanchez? Let me clarify that for you, Mr. Sanchez. You don't have to talk to me. We will get you a lawyer. It will be assigned, and assigned means free of charge. Like I pointed out in my brief, the Webster definition of assigned, nowhere in there does it say free of charge. And so to expect this uneducated immigrant, Spanish-speaking only, to understand that in the American judicial system, assigned also means you get a free lawyer is just not reasonable in this case.
Could I ask you to make a distinction for me? I wasn't sure. At times we seem to be arguing, or two things merge. Are you suggesting that the language that was used in this case was inadequate to satisfy the requirement of Miranda with regard to giving that warning? Or is your argument primarily that there was not an effective waiver, that it just was not an intelligent waiver because even though it was a good warning, he didn't understand it?
Both. First of all, in the proper context, if you're dealing with an English speaker who understands somewhat the American judicial system, who might have had criminal cases in the past, and they comprehend that assigned means free, that's fine. I'm saying in the totality of the circumstances here, given the fact that Sanchez clearly wanted a lawyer, but his only concern was his ability to pay for that lawyer, the word assigned didn't sufficiently clarify. So to you or I, knowing Miranda, knowing the criminal justice system, knowing we're entitled to free representation, that would be perfectly fine. It would stand up in court.
So there's no argument that there are magic words that have to be said in order to comply?
There are not. The totality of the circumstances must be considered, and that includes the particular circumstances of the defendant.
Could I follow up real quickly with one other? So did the defendant testify then?
He did not testify.
And how do we know what he understood then?
As far as what, Your Honor?
Well, you're saying he didn't understand. Or are you saying no one could understand? If he didn't testify and we don't know whether he understood or not, from his point of view, from what are we deducing that this was an inadequate warning?
Well, while he did not testify at the suppression hearing, his lawyer did file the motion on his behalf arguing these points. So obviously the lawyer, an officer of the court, had a good faith basis to go forward and believe that his client did not understand that one, that an assigned lawyer specifically meant a free lawyer. But the burden's on the prosecution, regardless, by the preponderance of evidence, to show that the waiver was valid. So they would have to be the ones to prove that he did understand it. It's not our burden to prove that he did not understand it. We're saying in these circumstances, it's not reasonable to believe that he would have understood that assigned equated to free of charge.
And just to pursue this one more second, the So if he's not testifying about what he understood or didn't, or how well he understood the language or what the cultural background was, then is the argument you're making that what? Any person whose language, whose first language is not English would not have understood this? Any person of this person's age or the number of years of education he had would not understand this? What's the category that this is an ineffective waiver with regard to?
Well, the defense attorney below made a number of representations and arguments arguing that this doesn't necessarily apply to anybody else. We're talking specifically about my client, Ricardo Sanchez, and under the circumstances that he was brought in and questioned and twice asked about a lawyer wanting money. And instead of clarifying that, as he should have, perhaps not for you or I, but for Mr. Sanchez, he brushed it aside. He said, yes, they are very expensive. They are going to want money. And then before he even finished his sentence, he said, the thing is, we're going to talk now or talk soon. So he didn't even give Sanchez an opportunity to come back and question him any further.
What was the factual basis for having the Spanish-speaking officer present in the first place?
I believe Mr. Sanchez was apprehended in New Mexico. He was fleeing arrest after he shot the victim.
Why is the interpreter there? Why was he suspended? What are the motions suppressed? What are the record facts of why there was a Spanish-speaking police officer talking to him, giving him Miranda off?
Well, I believe they testified that's their general practice when the person doesn't speak English.
Is there a record? Because I haven't read the transcript. Is there a record of whether this man only spoke Spanish?
Officer Mendez?
No.
Oh, yes. Officer Mendez testified Ricardo Sanchez spoke only Spanish. Spanish and only Spanish.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about Officer Mendez, and particularly about the dissent in the Court of Appeals decision.
Judge Fox.
Yes, Judge Fox's opinion. Judge Fox seems to suggest that Officer Mendez was not, in fact, a very good interpreter. Even still, he was not able to use the correct words. He hadn't had very much Spanish, things along that sort. He didn't use the right word for remain silent. He didn't use the correct word for other things. Could you comment on that? Do you think that we should look at the quality of the interpreter here in terms of the defendant's intelligent and voluntary waiver?
I think that's certainly one factor. Going specifically to our argument here, Judge Fox noted that what he said was don't have the exact Spanish words here, but essentially it was basically will be assigned. And our argument is that's fine. Let's take that will be assigned. That's not sufficient in these circumstances to convey to someone who's not familiar with the American criminal justice system that will be assigned means will be assigned at no charge to you. And he just needed to say those extra few words, and we wouldn't even be here today.
He did say, if I could just continue for 1 second, thank you. He did say, if you don't have the means, and it doesn't seem like anybody really talks about that word means, being not able to be understood. If you don't have the means, if you're not able to pay, what else could means mean exactly?
You know, Your Honor, I can't comment on that. To you or I, this would make perfect sense. If you didn't have the means of hiring a lawyer, one will be assigned. That would probably imply to your average person of intelligence, English speaker, educated, that we will assign one to you for free. But under these particular circumstances, given the fact that Sanchez had twice voiced his concern that a lawyer would cost money, and then Mendez, instead of saying, oh, no, you don't understand, they won't cost you any money, he says, yes, they are expensive. And then he goes on to say, if you don't have the means of hiring a lawyer, one would be assigned. But then before he can even pause, he says, but the things we are going to talk soon. So in our argument, under these circumstances, given this particular defendant, that's insufficient.
Counsel, could I pick up on that specific exchange?
Yes, ma'am.
We typically review these videos de novo.
Right.
And I took a look at that particular video and that critical exchange and was troubled to learn, or at least in my view, that the translation was a little bit inaccurate. I think that what actually was said was, pero la cosa es hacia donde estamos nosotros. Si vamos a hablar, vamos a hablar ahorita.
We're going to talk.
If we're going to talk, we're going to talk ahorita.
Right now.
Right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that also coupled with these comments, if you don't have the means, which could mean, I suppose, the connections. Do you know a lawyer?
That's a good point.
But the other point being, perhaps, look, the point is, we might be able to get you a lawyer down the line, but if we're going to talk, we're going to do it right now, suggesting that perhaps you wouldn't be able to get an attorney before the questioning. Do you read it that way at all? Am I misinterpreting?
I think that makes perfect sense, and I agree completely. The way in which Mendez phrased his responses to Sanchez was, they're very expensive. If you have the means, one will be assigned, but we're going to talk now, or soon as it was translated. But you're correct. Ahorita means now. I think that's very important in the analysis because it shows that Mendez had absolutely no intention of fully conveying to Sanchez, yes, we can get you a lawyer right now before you talk to me, and he will be free. He didn't adequately address Sanchez's concerns, and in addition to the mistranslations, even if you take it for what it is, for what it was translated to be, it's still completely insufficient. But I think when you add in the fact that a lot of the transcript, the interpretation was mistranslated, that is even one more factor that this court can consider.
Here's my concern. Were you finished?
I just had one final comment, since we're on the topic of mistranslations. The other mistranslation that I noticed was immediately after that exchange, Mr. Sanchez asked, así es mejor, ¿verdad? This way is better, right? And the way it is translated in the transcript here, pues no digo que es mejor. Well, I don't say what it is better, but on the video, he actually does, he says instead, pues yo digo que es mejor. In other words, he said, I do say it is better.
Better, right.
And that's a very critical mistranslation.
Justice Marquez, can I ask you, it is better to talk? Is that how you...
So the exchange, as I understood it, was after the thing is, if we're going to talk, we're going to talk right now. Are you ready to talk? And the Mr. Sanchez said, this way is better, meaning to proceed right now. And the detective said, well, I say it is better.
I think that is critical, and that's something that I had actually not picked up on, and I guess neither did Judge Fox. But that just adds one more element of urgency that Mendez had. Look, we don't have time for a lawyer. Yes, they're expensive. We're going to talk now. I think it's better to go ahead and talk with me now. And that just adds to Sanchez's confusion or inability to fully understand that he could have an attorney there present, that he could speak and consult with an attorney before speaking to Mendez, and that the attorney would be provided free of charge.
Could you address the issue of harmlessness?
In the Attorney General's brief, they argue that even if this was error, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I cited People v. Grace, Colorado Appellate Court, 2001, that Under this standard, the court must be, quote, confident beyond reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict. I'm not saying that there wasn't sufficient evidence of second degree, that based on the facts there wasn't sufficient in the first degree, but that's not the issue here. The issue is whether, in the absence of the confession, would he might have gotten a lesser degree of culpability. Might he gotten second-degree murder? Might he gotten heat of passion? And I think that they can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that's improbable or impossible. The facts aren't great for my client. I will totally concede that. The morning of the shooting, he told his brother, goodbye, I'm tired of this life. The morning of the shooting, he gave his wife money, kissed her goodbye, and told her he loved her. But also, the morning of the shooting, his brother testified that he seemed happy. Also, the day of the shooting, the victim actually threatened to kill the defendant and took two steps towards him. Now, had we
not... And to commit violence on his wife.
Yes, he threatened to rape his wife and kill him. Now, I'm not saying that... Without the statement, the jury would have completely acquitted him. But the statement saying, look, I went and bought bullets and bought a gun specifically for the purpose of killing the victim the next day. If they did not have that statement, if all they had were those other facts, they very well could have found second-degree murder. Or they very well could have found some form of provocation or heat of passion.
Could I take you back to the to the warnings just for 1 second? You weren't suggesting, were you, that the defendant had to understand that he could have counsel appointed for him to represent him in the case for free, but simply he had to understand that a lawyer would be appointed for free to advise him in his interrogation with the police?
Yes. I mean, I think that that would come later down the road. I think that would be the duty of the trial judge or some advisement down the road. But at this point, we're solely focusing on whether he fully comprehended the fact that he did not have to pay for an attorney in order to either have one there or consult with prior to being questioned by the officer. And if there are no other questions...
Well, I want to ask one more, because Justice Coates asked a series of questions regarding... Well, let me put it this way. Why your client didn't testify in the suppression hearing regarding what he understood. Was there an opportunity to do so? Why didn't he do so? Do we need to remand this for further factual findings in a hearing about his version of what he understood?
I suppose this court could do that. I don't know why his defense attorney chose not to call him at the suppression hearing. It's often a judgment, a strategic call. When I was a trial lawyer, I often had to make that tough decision whether putting on the client and risking the prosecution getting into things that were beyond the scope of the Fourth Amendment issue or the suppression issue. So I can't comment on that, Your Honor.
Actually, before
yes,
you
ma'am.
Step away from the podium, do you think that this court's articulation of the three precepts in All You See adequately convey all of the required Miranda advisements?
I don't think it adequately sums up the other cases that this court has issued on what precisely the defendant must understand. For example, in Aguilar-Ramos, which was issued after Al Youssef, this court says officers must inform a suspect that he has a right to have an attorney present and that attorney will be appointed free of charge if the suspect cannot afford an attorney. People B. Regibald, issued after Aguilar-Ramos and Al Youssef, says defendant has a right to have an attorney present and that an attorney will be appointed if the accused cannot afford one. So it's very clear that I'm not saying Al Youssef was wrongly decided. I think the three precepts in Al Youssef are correct, but based on the facts of Al Youssef, I think it was sufficient. But in this case, it doesn't go far enough, and the cases issued after Al Youssef fully elucidate the fact that a defendant must be advised and must understand that he is entitled to an attorney to be present there at the time, and that that attorney will be free of charge.
Thank you.
And if there are no other questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Emmy Langley, registration number 39075, and I represent the people in this matter. The defendant was properly advised under Miranda. Therefore, he understood he had the right to an appointed attorney. Miranda requires that prior to questioning, a person must be warned that he has the right to the presence of an attorney, either retained or appointed. Miranda does not require that those exact words be used, and it does not require that a defendant be specifically advised that his attorney will be free if he cannot afford one. If you don't have the means of hiring a lawyer, one will be assigned, means the same thing as you have the right to the presence of an attorney, either retained or appointed. The trial court, after watching the video of the interview and reading the transcript, found the defendant was not confused by the advisement. There was no need for the investigator to define assigned when there was no indication that the defendant did not understand its meaning. And I do not think it was clear that the defendant wanted a lawyer. When he spoke, he said, "Why go around it? True, what is done," indicating that he wanted to talk because what is done, not because he was interested in having a lawyer.
Well, don't we have plenty of cases that say if a person indicates an interest or wants a lawyer, that the interrogator ought to stop and clarify the request? And was there really any attempt here other than to get the defendant to speak? I don't see any indication that there's any stopping point here. He obviously is interested in the lawyer, and the hang-up he has is, well, I don't know one, and or I can't afford one. So what do you have to say about that body of cases, which doesn't seem to be really well briefed to me in either set of briefs?
Well, I don't think he asked for an attorney. I think he asked whether an attorney would want money, and the investigator very candidly answered, yes, you know, lawyers are expensive. Well, he said, lawyers going to want money, and the investigator responded, yes, lawyers are expensive, but if you don't have the means, one will be appointed, or one will be assigned, and there was no further questions. The defendant did not ask for an attorney, so I don't think there was an obligation.
Well, plainly, even for what you just said, he's interested in having a lawyer. He's concerned about the expense of it, right? Because he doesn't have any financial ability, apparently, to pay for one, and he thinks the system only has representation if somebody pays him, right? Isn't that the clear implication of this dialogue?
But after that, the investigator says, if you don't have the means, one will be assigned, and he still decides to talk, not asking for an attorney.
Well, the means of arranging, you know, he's sitting under custody. How does he get in connection with one?
Well, I think when he asks, is the lawyer, you know, a lawyer's going to want money, and then he says, if you don't have the means, in context, that means, as the Court of Appeals held, that if you don't have the means, if you don't have money, one will be assigned to you.
Well, you and I might understand that, but let's take it for the fact that he's purely a Spanish speaker. He is not familiar at all with how we do our legal process. He's probably thinking of a very different legal process. He's from Mexico, right?
Yes, but I don't think there's evidence below about, you know, his sophistication with the justice system or how much he knows, you know, what kind of system his own legal culture has. I think that those are assumptions that there's no evidence below. I mean, the trial court can't rely on evidence that's never presented.
My only point is this. The innovation that you're entitled to have a lawyer at all is a pretty recent innovation in U.S. legal history. There was plenty of times where if you couldn't afford one, you were without, right? I mean, that's in the lifetime of people sitting in this audience that this right was established. Now, if we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, we certainly don't have a sophisticated person who understands the legal system and what they're entitled to it. And isn't it the job of the interrogator to have at least a basic communication to one who doesn't otherwise understand what those rights are?
Well, I think, again, there's no evidence about his level of sophistication. It's perfectly plausible that he knew that an attorney would be assigned to him.
But the prosecutor bears the burden of proof, right?
Well, the prosecution showed by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant was not confused by the advisement, and the defense introduced no evidence about his level of sophistication, whether he understood the advisement. I mean, there's no evidence of that below. So the trial court can't consider evidence that wasn't presented about the defendant's level of understanding about our current justice system.
But the trial court did rely on the entire exchange. Apologize for my cold. And I guess my concern is written in the trial court order and quoted again, I think, in the Court of Appeals opinion, perhaps, this entire exchange, which, in my view, was mistranslated, including reliance on the mistranslation about we're going to talk soon, as opposed to what he really said, which was, if we're going to talk, we're going to talk now. And then the second mistranslation, no, I don't tell you what is better. Yes, I do think it is better.
Well, candidly, I was not aware of that until today. I think that the transcript was interpreted, and there was testimony that it was an accurate interpretation. The trial court relied on that.
But you would agree that we are entitled to look at the videotape, and it's preserved, right? We're entitled independently to look at the videotape and make that judgment ourselves.
That's correct. You can look at the videotape and make the judgment yourself. I'm not sure about whether you can, after the transcript is certified as fair and accurate, whether that you can make findings outside of that. But I do, regarding your concern, the defendant did sign a written waiver on Miranda.
Which contained no advisement about the right to a free attorney.
Right, but it did tell him that he could stop talking at any time, that he did not have to talk.
Okay.
And so I think that advisement, that written waiver, is not contested on appeal. So I don't think there's an argument that the defendant didn't think that he could stop at any time or that he had to talk without an attorney present.
Well, if you're finished, let me ask a couple of questions along those lines. So there was a transcript which was certified as true and correct. The trial judge evidently could not speak Spanish. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that's true.
And so that the trial judge, reviewed that transcript, and the testimony of Officer Mendez, the officer, and it was on that basis that she found that it was a good waiver. Is that right?
That's true, yes.
All right, and then it seems that at the Court of Appeals level, we have one of the members of the court, I guess Judge Fox, who was able to review it and spoke Spanish and was able to provide her own translation. So what do you think about that, given that we can, in fact, review de novo the actual tape, not just the transcript? We can go back, we the appellate judges, go back and look at the actual tape.
Well, I think the videotape can go to the defendant's demeanor.
Could you speak maybe just inch louder?
Oh, sorry. I think the videotape goes to the defendant's demeanor. You can look at it to see whether his body language showed that he understood the advisement, whether he was confused at any point, and I think that's what those line of cases are talking about when they say that you can review.
So you don't think we can go back and provide a new translation? We, the appellate judges.
I do not think so. I don't have a cite for that. But I do think it's unfair to the trial court if they have a transcript that's certified as accurate and the defense makes no other argument and they rely on that, and then on appeal there's a different argument.
Don't we have a basic duty to protect these guaranteed individual rights? And if there seems to be a problem with the translation, have a review of what that videotape actually says?
I think that if this court finds that the interpretation is very troubling, then maybe the right thing to do is to remand for the transcript to be looked at again. But I don't think that that's necessary here, because the defendant signed a written waiver telling him that he could stop talking at any time, he did not have to talk, and that waiver is not contested on appeal.
The conflict is really this whole thing that we call de novo, which means every step of the way, the judges who are looking at it get to look at it fresh, as if nobody had ever looked at it before. Right?
That's correct.
So given that, what would be the benefit of us sending it back to the trial court to say, take another look at it? She could do that, but then it would come back to us and we could take another look at it. Wouldn't that get to be kind of circular?
Well, I think on appeal, the de novo review has to go with, like, you can look at the record, and the record shows the interpretation. I don't think that you can, I would argue that this court cannot look outside what the record says. So the record says, here's what this interpretation is, and then you look at the interpretation and decide whether it is, whether the defendant validly waived his Miranda rights.
Can I take you back one second, just to the question about providing a lawyer again? Is there anything in Miranda or the law implementing it that requires the police to provide a lawyer at the station or with any time frame on behalf of the defendant, or does it simply prevent the police from interrogating him if he wants a lawyer?
I think what Miranda says is that the police cannot question that. Your Fifth Amendment right is so important that without a lawyer present, the police cannot question you. I don't think that it further says the police have an obligation to find a lawyer for you if you would like one.
And so when we talk about advising the defendant that a lawyer will be provided for him free of charge if he can't afford one, that means if the police are going to interrogate him.
That's correct. Because Miranda only talks about your Fifth Amendment right. There's nothing beyond the Fifth Amendment right. So it's only to have an attorney present during questioning before charges are filed.
Could you walk us through the body of evidence that you would rely on to say that, let's assume all of this was mistranslated, let's assume that the Miranda waiver was ineffective, why is it harmless in this case?
Well, because the defendant, in my brief, I talk about the different things the defendant did beyond the confession. He first went to his brother and he said, goodbye, I'm tired of this life, right before he shot the defendant. He reloaded his gun twice, shot the defendant in the back of the head after reloading the gun. And before he went to work, he told his wife goodbye. He took a different car that she testified he only takes to go long distances. And he also told one of his co-workers that nobody makes fun of my family, the Sanchezes. And also, I think that it's relevant, as I said in my brief, that the confession was the only basis for the defendant's self-defense claim. There's no other basis for his claim outside of the confession. There's no record that the victim ever.
Was there not testimony that the victim took two steps toward him? I mean, outside of the confession, was there not testimony that the victim took two steps toward him and said something offensive right before he shot, or am I misremembering?
I think the testimony shows that the defendant walked towards the victim first and then they had an exchange, but I don't think it was the defendant walked towards him with threatening his life. There's no evidence of a threat of deadly force in the record.
In your brief, a couple of places you used the phrase there was ample evidence to convict him.
Right.
And would you agree, though, the standard is that we have to find
evidence
beyond a reasonable doubt there was no reasonable possibility that affected the verdict?
Well, I think confessions, there's no, if a confession is admitted in error, it's not structural error. So it's certainly possible that a confession can be admitted in error and then it's still harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And by ample, I meant overwhelming evidence. And I think the, go ahead.
You're not quite coming through to me.
Oh, okay. I think the defendant in the confession says the The most harmful part about the confession is that he bought bullets and a gun, but from the record, we know that the defendant had a gun. He reloaded his gun twice, showing intent and deliberation to kill the victim.
But in effect, I appreciate all the facts you're telling us, but in effect, to find it harmless, don't we have to find that there was no reasonable possibility that the jury's verdict was affected by the fact that he flat out confessed that he intended to kill this guy?
That's correct.
Okay. Yes. And I think in your recitation of facts, if I were to supplement, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the victim continually taunted this fellow and threatened him and his family, and in particular his wife. And so there was some mitigating background to this. I'm not saying it completely excuses the criminal conduct, but it seems to me that that his confession is well, certainly the police officer was trying to get it at all costs. Would you agree with that? I mean, the officer didn't really pause and said, it's better to talk now. Tell me, and you know, that was in evidence before the jury, and if the jury has any sympathy towards the defendant regarding the fact that he's been bullied and his race has been cast down, his wife has been threatened by this guy, he comes ready for the next incident of this, right? So this fellow is advancing towards him and making the same kinds of statements. So there is a theory of a defense here and a mitigation, and I think it was argued by your opposing counsel that very much is in play, that without this confession, if it was illegally obtained, might come out different were the case retried. Would you tell me what your observation on that is?
The evidence that you're talking about, that his wife and family were threatened, was from the confession. So if the confession is suppressed, the jury would not know that. And then also, even if you look at the confession and the self-defense claim, the defendant admits in the confession that he did not kill the victim until the victim threatened and cursed his mother. In my opinion, I don't think self-defense was at issue in this case at all.
Could you respond to opposing counsel's comment, though, that without the evidence that the jury had through the confession, it might have reached a different verdict other than first-degree murder with, you know, after deliberation, might have reached a second-degree murder conviction or something other, something lesser?
Well, again, I think that the defendant points to the confession as showing that deliberation by the defendant going and buying a gun and buying bullets. But here, from the record, without the confession, we have the defendant shooting the victim, reloading the gun twice, clearly showing deliberation, reflection, judgment. I mean, it wasn't like he acted in self-defense instinctively and shot the victim once. I mean, he shot the victim multiple times, reloaded the gun. I think that the record overwhelmingly shows deliberation. If there are no further questions, I ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
I completely agree. There was sufficient evidence for first-degree murder here. That's why I didn't raise it in the brief. But that's not the standard. The standard is whether they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this affected the verdict in any way. And if you take out his statement saying, I intended to kill this guy on the day I killed this guy. I bought a gun for the purpose of killing this guy. I got bullets for the purpose of killing this guy. Then you might have ended up with a different verdict. You might have ended up with second-degree murder. You might have ended up with some sort of heat of passion. But the fact that he admitted to premeditation in his confession is fundamental, is critical. And I don't think that they can show beyond a reasonable doubt, that the error did not contribute to the verdict.
Could I ask you to comment on that issue of translation? as among the various court levels, please?
Well, as this court knows, factual findings are generally given deference. However, if they're shown to be clearly erroneous, this court can set them aside and review it de novo. And I think that gets back to Justice Marquez's point, is that she reviewed on behalf of this court the actual interview and determined that it was erroneously translated. And I think under those circumstances, this court can overrule or brush aside the trial court's factual findings on that matter. And in suppression matters in particular, the final legal determination is always reviewed de novo.
Counsel, can I just ask you, though, to directly address your opposing counsel's point that that error was not preserved? I mean, the transcript was certified as accurate, fair and accurate, true and accurate, but there was no challenge to that below. Can you raise a challenge to the accuracy of the transcript at this level? I guess this is the question.
I don't think we're procedurally barred from doing that. I think that, as Justice Hobbs said, this court has a duty to correct these fundamental problems and errors that it finds. And when it comes across something that's fundamentally erroneous, a factual finding, it can brush the trial court's factual finding aside and substitute it for its own.
Do you think we need to appoint our own translator then?
I suppose you could.
How do you decide which translator would be the one that would be correct?
I suppose this court could do that, or it could take its fellow justices' word for accurate translation, or it could even just reference a Spanish dictionary, for instance.
Well, we have a certification of translators program now and an agreement with the Justice Department to get fair, accurate, honest translations at work, so it seems that we would have the means to have it at least checked by a certified translator that works for the courts, correct?
Yes, sir, and I don't think there's any bar on this court doing that.
Can I ask you just a slight variation of that, which probably is more typical, or make them up? If we have a videotape of a interrogation from the police station, and we have a transcript of that that was used down below and was not objected to by either party, but when we listen to the videotape, watch it, if we decide, and it's not uncommon that there are words or phrases or things that somebody says that are not entirely clear, that didn't really come out on the microphone, but if we decide we think we hear something different maybe from what the translation was that was or the transcript that was accepted down below by both parties, are we at liberty then to even though it's not a language problem, are we at liberty to simply say we hear it differently?
Well, I think 7 years are better than one. And
14 years.
Yeah.
14 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Good point.
Because I've used it.
I tried to be funny and ended up looking stupid. But the point is that, yes, I think this court can pretty much do whatever it wants. And if it finds an error below and there is substantial agreement on the court, it can supplant the trial court's findings of fact as to that or any other certified finding of fact. Now, if certain justices disagree, they can file dissents or whatnot, but I don't think there's anything fundamentally barring that. I don't think there's any doctrine that says that this court cannot do that.
This may be obvious to the students, but I just want to make sure that that they and we understand that what's at issue here is not this person going free,
right,
walking out of the jail. Will you explain what the process is,
right,
in case we were to agree with your position?
Well, everybody always asks me, well, how does it feel to get all these murderers and rapists off? And my general response is, well, 99% of the time, I don't get any play in the Supreme Court or Court of Appeals. But when I do, the majority of the time, it's just a matter of getting someone a new trial. It's not a matter of freeing them and letting Mr. Sanchez walk out the door a free man. It's a matter of whether he got a fair trial or not. And in this particular case, if my side wins, they would suppress the confession, and so the jury would not be able to hear the fact that he intended to kill this guy, that he admitted to intending to kill this guy, that he bought a gun for the sole purpose of intending to kill this guy, and the evidence would proceed at a new trial without that. And the question is, well, could he receive a different verdict? And in my opinion, our position is he could receive a different verdict. He could get something lesser than first-degree murder based on the facts.
And first-degree murder is life in prison without parole.
Without parole. So it's a big consequence here today to Mr. Sanchez. If there are no other questions, I would ask you to reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both attorneys for your arguments and your briefs. The case will be decided by the court on the briefs. And we will take the